Now, let's not bullshit, Maverick. Your family name ain't the best in the Navy. You need to be doing it better and cleaner than the other guy. Now, what is it with you?
Just want to serve my country, be the best fighter pilot in Navy, sir!
Don't screw around with me, Maverick. You're a hell of an instinctive pilot. Maybe too good. I'd like to bust your butt, but I can't. I got another problem here. I gotta send somebody from this squadron to Miramar. I gotta do something here. I still can't believe it. I gotta give you your dream shot. I'm gonna send you up against the best. You two characters are going to Top Gun.
Do you podcast listeners feel the need? The need for speed?
You can run, kid. You can't hide.
Well, then gear up as the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast bring you the Top Gun Retrospective Series.
I have to admit, I wasn't expecting an invitation back.
Join Garrett.
You always go home with the hot women.
Matt.
His exploits are legendary.
And Adam.
You can be my wingman anytime.
As they go inverted and dive right into the Tom Cruise starring original film.
Is this your idea of fun, man?
And then review the brand new Joseph Kosinski directed Top Gun Maverick, due in theaters May 27th.
Son, your ego is writing checks your body can't cash.
How do the boys feel that 1986 original has aged?
It's one of life's mysteries, sir.
Did any of them enjoy the movie at all?
That's classified.
And what the hell took so long to get the sequel going?
I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you.
Find out the answers to these questions and more, all coming up here at Percolated Media.
All right, talk to me, Goose.
Top Gun, released May 16th, 1986. Budget on this was $15 million. Box office, $357.1 million. And this is directed by a guy that Matt has been bugging me to do a retrospective of for years, Mr. Tony Scott. Welcome to the Tony Scott retrospective. No, welcome to Top Gun. You know, guys, I cannot believe we are talking about Top Gun. I always said if we were ever going to do Top Gun, it'd be because they finally made a new Top Gun. And guess what? We have one coming right out. The time we record this is coming out within 2 weeks. Oh, boy. I cannot believe this is happening. I'm joined by Mr. Matthew Goudreau. What's up, Matt?
I feel the need to finish this beer in the next 5 seconds and get a new one.
And the one and only, probably a guy I watched this with a couple times back in the day, Mr. Adam Bunge. What's up, Adam?
Oh, good. It's been a tiring last couple weeks. I'm so glad that I could be on here playing with my boys.
The excess of lines in this movie, there are too many to pull. When we did Fantastic Beasts a couple weeks ago, I wanted to do a whole new intro, a whole new outro. And it's tough pulling lines from that movie. This, by the time I was done pulling the lines, I still had about maybe 10 left that I could have put in with one of these intros. There's just too many to pull here. I had an interesting experience watching this movie for the very first time. When I was a kid, I did not see this in theaters, obviously. I had no idea that this was even out. You know, I mean, I'm a precocious little 9-year-old just caring about where my Star Wars figures are pretty much at that time. Not really discovering new things, but when I went to a friend's house, I was excited because we were going to watch, it was on pay-per-view that night, WrestleMania 3. And after it was over, it was followed by Top Gun, and we're like, what's this little movie? Let's check this out. So we asked his mom, can we get Top Gun? And mom was like, yeah, go ahead. So we went ahead and ordered it. And that was my first time experiencing this movie. And I loved it at that time. Adam, I'm sure I watched this with you a number of times. What was your first experience watching this?
Yeah, I can tell you what my first was. This is one of those movies, kind of like when we talked about Bond and some of those that I knew was just always on in the background. This is one that just my dad had always played this movie. I know we had a VHS copy of it in the house. We had a black box growing up like a lot of us did around that time. So this was on, you know, HBO, Showtime, and those were premium channels. It was just on. It was a constant in the house that was just always there. Yeah, when this was in theaters, I would have been, let me see, 86. So yeah, I would have been six or seven, depending on the time of year. That time of year, I would have been six. So I definitely didn't see it in theaters, but it was always on.
All right. Well, it was always on in Adam's house. This was released about 7 years before Goudreau was born. Goudreau, what was your first experience watching Top Gun, sir? This should be interesting.
Oh, gee, let's ask the gay man what his thoughts on we're watching Top Gun for the first time. This will be quite the conversation. So I don't have a memorable first viewing, largely because this is in that vein of movies where I knew the pop culture ambiance around it to the point where it was tough to watch the movie and not know what was going to happen, whether it was the quotes I knew, whether it was the, I can't even call them subtext with the homoeroticism, because there is no such thing as subtext in this movie, but I didn't respond to it as well as I thought I would. And it was one of the last Tony Scott movies I actually saw for someone who's one of my all-time favorite directors. Part of that is just due to knowing what the movie was. I knew the plot synopsis before ever actually seeing it. So it was tough for me to get a fully authentic viewing experience out of it, because I felt like part of it was ruined for me. The cachet was off. Maybe if I had seen it earlier and not waited as long as I had, it would have been slightly different.
Yeah, this thing, it made over $355 million, $177 million stateside. It was the highest grossing movie of 1986, beating out Crocodile Dundee and a little movie called Platoon, which ended up winning the Oscars that year. And for 1986 money, boys, that's pretty damn good. And by the way, Matt, we will be talking gay subtext. We'll probably have more gay subtext talks in this than we did Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2 with how much we have going on in this particular movie. And you know what? It's interesting because they've been threatening a sequel for so long and we're finally getting it. I cannot believe it. And this is another one that when I pitched it to the place we were at before, they kind of scoffed at it. They were like, why would you do Top Gun? And I'm like, boy, you know how much subtext we could talk about with this movie? Like Tony Scott, we got James Toback, we got Tom Cruise, and I mean, there's so much shit we can get into with this. Now, Tony Scott was interesting. This was his first big movie right after The Hunger. And did you guys ever see Hunger, by the way?
Oh, I've seen it. As the David Bowie super fan, I watched that movie on a loop probably three times in the span of a week. There was a period where I watched it incessantly.
Wow.
It's been quite a while for me, but as somebody who absolutely loves David Bowie, yeah, definitely seen it.
Wow. See, I've never seen it myself, honestly. I think that's the one movie I haven't seen of his. You know, and he always seemed like just like a rent version of his brother to me. Yeah, the aesthetic is very 80s, and there's very 80s stuff that we'll talk about here. Some of it doesn't age well at all. But a lot of it we still see today. And that's the one thing about Tony Scott was, if you watch Beverly Hills Cop 2, that thing is so goddamn slick. Like, it could be a Michael Bay film.
So since you brought up Tony Scott, let me take the floor here for a bit and kind of talk about why Tony Scott is as important as, or maybe he's not as important as he should be, because the modern day action movies can be traced back to filmmakers from the 90s like Michael Bay, Simon West, who got their start in an almost identical way as Tony Scott did. They were all commercial directors. But Scott's style, the orange slash teal aesthetic that a lot of his movies have, the way that he changed shootouts from these one man with a machine gun, you know, the John Rambo style, to ducking and cover with handguns, and the car chases, the crazy editing, all of that is indebted to Tony Scott, and he has still done it better than almost anybody. And unlike his brother, while he does not have an Alien on his resume, you know, that all-time classic movie that's going to be on the greatest hits forever, he's got a more consistent track record, and I think Tony Scott had a better grasp on character than Ridley Scott has ever had. And he doesn't have that period like Woody Allen where he'd make three bad movies for every one good one. Tony's movies weren't always the best, but there was always a passion and there was a thought process for what he was doing. Even when his editing got fucking insane towards the end of his career with stuff like Domino, where it's so hyper-connected, it's almost difficult to watch.
Yeah, it is difficult to watch.
But he has been, starting from Top Gun through, you know, the late 90s, he had this amazing run where all of his stuff, very different too. He's one of the few directors, I think, because he's worked, this launched Tom Cruise into the stratosphere. You look at what he did for Will Smith and Enemy of the State, Denzel Washington. He's one of the few directors to take these big movie stars and say, hey, while this will be a big piece for you, you have to work in tandem with me, and your voice is not going to overshadow mine. And that's why I think he's one of the great directors of all time, is that he didn't let anyone's ego run roughshod over him, especially with guys like Will Smith and, you know, Bruce Willis with Last Boy Scout, where that could have very well been the case.
Well, according to him, it did happen on The Last Boy Scout, and he said he would never work with Bruce Willis again after that experience.
Well, that makes sense.
You're not the first nor the last to make that comment.
You're not kidding. You know, it's weird. I can't agree with you when it comes to Tony Scott. There are a few really good movies on his resume that I will always bat for. Man on Fire is a movie that, it's one of my top 20 movies of all time. It's so good.
Since you talked about Man on Fire, it is, I'm not sure if Adam's seen it. It came out in 2004, and it's still the best Punisher movie that's ever been made.
It's fantastic.
It pistol whips the shit out of the actual Punisher movie that came out that same year.
But I don't know, man. I think Unstoppable, I think, is it's popcorn fun. You know, I think that was his last film, actually. There's stuff that I do really like, but most of it, his aesthetic's great, but for the most part, his characters don't really work for me.
If you go, up and down through his resume, there's just a number of films that huge fan of. I don't think I saw his last decade of work as I'm looking at it, which is actually kind of sad. I don't think I've seen anything that he made after Spy Game, which is something I saw in theaters and I think is, I don't know if underrated is the right word, but I think it deserves more credit than it's got. Big fan of Enemy of the State, just because it was, I don't know, something a little different. How many times did we watch Crimson Tide?
Oh, yeah.
You want to talk about a movie that played on a loop my senior year of high school?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we saw it in theaters, too.
Yeah, The Fan I really enjoy. Last Boy Scout is fun for me. Days of Thunder is a classic. His filmography, like I said, I've missed the last couple. I think I saw Domino, which I enjoy as a, 90-minute music video, essentially, the way that it's cut.
2 hours.
Yeah, that thing's
that long? That,
yeah, it's really long.
Damn. But also, he directed one of my favorite movies in True Romance.
And yeah.
Quentin gets all the tension for that because of it's Quentin Tarantino, the first script, yada, yada. That may be more story than anything else. The 15-year-old wonder kid still, selling his first script. But damn, I love that movie. I really do. I mean, Scott, up and down, I think Matt hit it. He doesn't have the valleys of his brother, but he doesn't have the peaks either. Tony Scott didn't sell a movie, but he made some good movies.
Yeah. And in the same way that Man on Fire is the best Punisher movie ever made, I still maintain that The Last Boy Scout is the best Die Hard sequel ever made.
Oh, boy.
Even though Bruce Willis is a prick behind the scenes, it's one of his best roles.
He's playing John McClane. Okay. We're not getting into a Last Boy Scout discussion here. Bringing it back to Top Gun, you guys mentioned Quentin Tarantino. Top Gun came and went, and like I said, it was a major hit. Massive hit. It kind of came and went, and I didn't really watch it again for quite a while. It wasn't until Tarantino had a monologue about Top Gun in one of his movies. I don't remember exactly which one.
Sleep with Me.
Yeah. It kind of made the rounds, and I was just like, you know what? He's so right. And Top Gun became kind of a joke for a while there for me. But in the last, I'd say 10 years, I've watched it probably a good 8 or 9 times. It just kind of, I hate to say this, it flies by. It was just popcorn entertainment for me, which is, again, how I look at a lot of Tony Scott stuff, which is why I like Man on Fire so much, because it actually got deep and I actually felt for the people in that movie. All right, boys, we ready for this? I don't know. Do we call this a plot?
I guess. I mean, this discussion is going to take your breath away, but let's start.
It's definitely going to take my voice away. So we get a huge soliloquy in the beginning here, which I thought was Tony Scott's brother's thing. Like, I thought this was really Scott's thing to have all these words before the start of a movie. Anyway, it says a bunch of stuff about how the Navy established a school for the top 1% of its pilots, and how today the Navy calls it Fighters Weapons School, whereas the Flyers call it Top Gun. I don't know. I guess it sets the mood here. What do you guys think about this opening soliloquy here? It's a weird way to open a big summer film, isn't it?
It is, but I think you get all the info that you need. I'm generally a fan of show, don't tell. But being that it doesn't, doesn't really matter later, but it gives you enough of kind of setting up a characterization for all the characters we're going to meet as well. It's just, bam, it's simple as playing, and we can go from there.
Context is key with this introduction because the Navy, the U.S. Navy, especially around this time, we were at a very strange point in history. It's so funny this came out the same year as Platoon, because they are antithetical to one another as far as their depictions of the U.S. military. This might as well be a recruitment video. When you go back and watch it now, as far as joining in the Navy, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Top Gun was not something a lot of people were familiar with, especially your everyday citizen. So you needed to tell people that this is something that's above and beyond the standard call of duty, that this is it's as prestigious as it gets. And this is a movie that also, it has character beats and background for characters, but a lot of the key details are not exposed until the last third of the movie, which makes it a really interesting movie to look at analytically with how it tells you about these characters.
Yeah, you guys mentioned this could be a recruitment video. Interestingly enough, in 1986, they did have Navy officers and recruitment tables outside the theater, so that when people got out of the theater and they saw that, they wanted to become a member, and it worked. Numbers skyrocketed after this movie came out, which I always thought was a little interesting. Although, once you get there, they do fine you like $5 for each and every time you quote a line from this movie. So, but yeah, it was a recruitment video. Like, the Navy used this to its advantage. Pretty interesting to look at, because like you said, Matt, this was an interesting part of our history where, you know, we had the Cold War going on, but, you know, we had Oliver Stone obsessed with Vietnam, and he had those movies going on, and he won an Oscar for the one this year, but no one was really thinking about the Navy or any of what was going on in the sky. So I thought that was an interesting way of taking this project. We get a little montage to open things with Beverly Hills Cop's own Harold Faltermeyer throwing things into a calm mood with the score right before Kenny Loggins barrels in with the first of what I counted 80 times we hear Danger Zone in this movie.
Danger Zone.
Now, before I get to that piece of music and the other songs on the soundtrack, what do you guys think of this montage and score from Faltermeyer? If I'm being honest, I think Faltermeyer's score is grossly underrated. When I hear people talk about the music to this movie, and yes, I used to own the vinyl album to this. Adam can attest to that.
Yep.
You know, it's either Berlin or Kenny Loggins. I think Faltermeyer should get mentioned more. I think his score is great.
I'm all right when it comes to Kenny Loggins. So I will just say I think his music is fine, but the score, the main guitar riff that they keep using, it almost, I have to expect Guns N' Roses to come out of the woodwork at least three times throughout this movie. It's good. It gets your blood pumping, which is what you want for this kind of movie. So I don't have any objections when it comes to the music.
Yeah, I think Kenny Loggins obviously gets all the attention. Little side note, I met him on a plane our senior year when I was traveling with my choir to Hawaii. He was on the same plane we were flying in, came back and meet us all, which is kind of cool. I think it was at the same time he was writing music for the Winnie the Pooh movie that Tennessee just redone.
Oh, that's funny.
But yeah, I mean, everybody talks about Kenny Loggins for damn good reason, and Berlin for damn good reason. But the score, I think it's overlooked, and it's really, really good. I made a note and took it this time. I'm like, you know, you have the songs, which it gives that music video feel, but the score really drives it from the beginning to the end. And yeah, should be heralded a little more than it is.
I mean, you could not escape Kenny Loggins during the 80s if you were
in
movie theater.
No.
You had Caddyshack, you had Footloose, you had garbage like Over the Top, and they still called
it. Hey, don't be talking down on Over the Top, sir.
Even the Caddyshack 2.
Now
that you can talk down on. So we're on the Indian Ocean in the present day as Maverick and Goose, they head up to fight. Well, what are they? Where are they from? Because one thing about this movie that is just baffling to me is we spend about 85% of it in training up in the air, and the other 15% fighting unknown TIE fighter pilots, which is what I started calling them throughout the course of this. Who is this that we're fighting? And that's going to be a question I'm going to keep asking, especially in the finale. Do they ever specify?
No, because they probably wanted to keep it as universal as possible to not offend anybody. They were just out of Vietnam not too long before this. We had the Cold War going on. It would have been in bad taste to make it like the Germans or the Japanese. You don't want to predate yourself too much. So keeping it ambiguous and mysterious, I think, was the right move. It didn't bother me that they were just being bothered by unidentified bogeys throughout this and the climax.
Yeah, it seems like they wanted to make him North Korea, you know, but maybe that's looking at it through today's lens. I don't know if they would have been somebody that we would have been thinking of back then, especially with the Cold War that was going on. So, yeah, it's generic TIE fighter pilot 1 through 7.
Fighter pilots. I have expected someone to say Maverick, what are you doing? You switched off your targeting computer.
Use the finger, Luke.
We're going to be seeing a lot of references to Star Wars, I think, throughout the course of this, believe it or not. We also see James Toback, 1 year removed from Back to the Future. I always like seeing this guy. And one thing that you also notice from the beginning, and another part of this movie's reputation, it is indeed one of the sweatiest movies ever made, isn't it? Like, yeah, everybody in this room is sweating. Everybody up in the air is sweating. Like, there's not one person in this who is not sweating.
But that's the Tony Scott aesthetic. He loves his claustrophobia. You know, this and Crimson Tide. It's a lot of militaristic hotshots stuck in rooms that are probably 120 degrees.
Yeah, it's like they're sprayed down with a bottle of water more than WWE does before they let them through the curtain.
By the way, Cruz saying, talk to me, Goose, I say that all the time in my life, mostly on the radios at my work. Sometimes if they call my, you know, they'll say, Manager Garrett, can you copy? And I said, talk to me, Goose. I still say it to this day. It's like it's in my vernacular, even before I was hearing about this sequel coming out.
You know, the only person who probably doesn't want to hear that anymore is Anthony Edwards.
No, you're not kidding.
This man won how many Emmys for ER? And they still come up to him and say, hey, Goose, what's up?
He will be remembered for two things, Goose and Revenge of the Nerds.
Revenge of the Nerds, exactly. Yeah.
We will be talking about him, though, when we do Pet Sematary 2.
Oh, that's right. That's right. He's Edward Furlong's dad. Oh, I can't wait for that discussion in 5 years.
I mean, shit, when it comes to ER, I still think of George Clooney, and he was the first one to leave that show.
Exactly. It's so funny. That's what he tried doing for years after this, was he tried getting this, you know, in the back burner and having people forget it. And I'm sorry, Anthony, it's not happening. You're going to be remembered as Goose, I'm sorry to say, especially with the sequel coming out. So we have Merlin up here, Tim Robbins, 19 years before Cruise would find him going nuts in a bunker.
Speaking of Stephen King, future Stephen King alumni.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'll be talking about him, too. Is this what pushed him over the edge? Like, I almost look at this as like a prequel to War of the Worlds, where being up here with Cruise is what made him go absolutely bonkers by the end of War of the Worlds.
In the same week that we're recording this, there was some brand new congressional hearings on UFOs. So, yes, I think that's exactly what made him go nuts.
Well, let's not forget, a little movie called Howard the Duck also came out this year.
Oh,
and it's
God.
not like that did him any favors. So I'm sure he was taking any piece of work, because he was still up and coming at the time.
He was, yeah.
He had only done, like, I don't know, Fraternity Vacation with frickin' Cameron Dye.
Yeah, and Howard the Duck we will be covering when we get to Marvel. And, oh my God, I'm not looking forward to that. One thing I'll give this movie is, this was before CGI technology, and all these flying sequences are filmed in real time with an ever slight bit of models being used here. But man, does it look fucking good.
So the biggest compliment you can give the movie is the technical expertise. You can tell they consulted with the actual Navy to figure out the choreography. But you have to remember, not a lot of CGI. Very few miniatures are utilized, so it's all stunt work and stuff. And it still holds up. Prior to this, you just had the Howard Hughes movies from the 20s and 30s and Clint Eastwood's movie Firefox. That was really the basis of fighter pilots. So this was kind of breaking new ground.
Yeah, I mean, right from the initial launch off of the carrier, it's kind of amazing just how well this thing is shot and how amazing these jets look. It's, yeah, phenomenal that they were able to do this 36 years ago, probably filmed 38 years ago. I mean, crazy that they got this to look as good as it did. Movies nowadays, practically shot, would not look nearly as well as this is. Movies where they try to fake it and do CG, Falcon and the Winter Soldier, don't look anywhere near as good as this when you have dogfights and shit.
So Cougar gets his jet locked on by a TIE fighter. Yes, I'm just going to keep calling them TIE fighters. And Maverick and Goose, they give the pilot the finger, take his picture, and they go on their way. But Cougar is not having fun. Apparently, the fact that he was locked on really messed with his head, and he's having a hard time landing the plane. Now, Cougar is played by someone that we are also going to be covering in the Stephen King retrospective, boys, Mr. John Stockwell. He was in John Carpenter's Christine.
That's right.
Now, here's what I don't understand. Cougar was on the brink of going to Top Gun before Goose, but this one issue makes him turn in his wings and leave the Navy?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It felt like shorthand to me.
I guess he had a really bad case of just PTSD or something, because it's not really – there's not a lot of talk about him having mental issues prior to this, which, to be fair, a lot of this movie is written with the depth of a puddle. And because of that, a lot is left unexplained, but the movie is so propulsive that I can't criticize it too much because it's not about character. It is similarly entirely about spectacle and seeing it on the biggest screen with the best sound system possible, which, by the way, if you have the Blu-ray and any kind of surround sound setup, this is one of your go-to experiences you can have at your house.
It is absolutely awesome in surround sound.
I laugh at him at the, because he has the picture of his family in the front. And I saw Tim Robbins, and I thought of fucking Green Lantern.
Oh, Jesus.
All the Hal Jordan flashbacks. I was like,
oh, my God.
This would be making me think about shittier movies.
Oh, that's right. Tim Robbins even had to do Green Lantern. How does he still work? It's, you know, Matt brings it. Yes, good question. Is it shorthand? Yeah, you know, absolutely. We whipped through. But I think it also takes an interesting course to chart, as in our hero, our protagonist, he's not number one. It really would have been easy just to be, yes, he helped save Merlin and Cougar, get him down and everything else, and way to go, kid. We knew you were the right choice to go to Top Gun. No, that's not how it is. This is a, you know, arrogant, brash little asshole that's second place that gets to go only because his buddy quits. And when you think about it, that chip on his shoulder has got to be something that's motivating him throughout. So it's a little bit of extra character that really didn't have to be there, but I think it does something for it.
That's a great point, actually, because Lord knows, I mean, it's really hard to like Tom Cruise in this movie, but you're absolutely right that that does give it a little bit more depth.
Well, he needs all the chips on his shoulder possible because they make him a few inches taller.
Maverick lands, but he's concerned about Cougar, so he takes back off with very little fuel and leads Cougar to his landing, which is pretty much how I landed each and every time I played the Nintendo game based on this fucking movie.
Oh, great fucking game, though.
Oh, my God. It's fucking impossible, dude. Fuck that game, man. I was so, this game cost me about three controllers landing these fucking planes. It was so hard.
But you have to remember, all those NES movie tie-in games were impossible. There was this.
Yeah.
There was the Jaws video game.
Oh,
you
God.
Had to go from port to port in your scuba diver fighting Jaws. It it took a long time for movie tie-in games to become somewhat manageable to beat on a standard difficulty.
I mean, they did have a level where you had to refuel.
Oh, my God. That's
you
right.
Just kind of had to line up that little hose right at the front of your jet. Oh, good times.
But that's more PTSD, is when we had to fuel that fucking plane. I forgot about that. So we get the scene where Cougar turns in his wings over his feelings of fright over his wife and son, and we get the principal yelling at Maverick and Coos that, yes, they fucked up. Maverick even banged an admiral's daughter, but they have been chosen to go to Top Gun. All right, so we get another danger zone shot as Maverick rides his motorcycle into Top Gun. We get a lecture from Michael Ironside, another one. Go-to from the 80s. And Wingman is played by Rick Rosevich, who's an interesting dude because he actually trained with Arnold Schwarzenegger way back when. I was trying to be as big a star as him, yet the most prominent role I remember him from, besides Slider here, is he was in Arnold's Tales from the Crypt directorial effort where he played the new body of William Hickey.
Oof.
Yes, go look that up, kids.
A good episode.
It was a great episode, actually.
It's the one where Schwarzenegger actually shows up in the opening.
Yes, box. Yeah. Yeah, I can't believe you saw that, Matt. Wow.
It's one of my favorite shows. I love Tales from the Crypt.
Val Kilmer, another one that, you know, gets... I mean, this was his big, big break. And you know what? As the antagonist, I don't find him to be too bad here. How do you guys... And he didn't want to take this. You know, he wanted to be the more deep role, man. He wanted to take the deep roles. He thought this was silly. But he took it, and I don't know. I think he's okay here. How do you guys feel about Val Kilmer in this?
I think his personality, much like his height, kind of towers over Tom Cruise in this movie. He's got chops, but he's not showing a hell of a lot of it. I'm a huge fan of his work later on. The Doors, I think, is an absolutely just genius film. The Salt and Sea, I think, is where probably his best acting he's done. So I'm a fan of Kilmer. And in this, he's a damn good presence. I mean, everybody loves Maverick, but damn, it's hard to not like Iceman as well. Just because you got that. I mean, he's not really he's the closest thing you have in a villain other than the TIE fighter pilots. You know, he's cool. He's the number one. He is the best. And yeah, I mean, Kilmer brings it for what he's allowed to do with it. You know, he's not the star, but it's a star-making performance, at least for him.
All right, Matt. Lace into Val Kilmer. You've been lacing into Val Kilmer for the 7 years we've been doing this show. What do you have to say here?
So I have a love-hate relationship with Val Kilmer because, A, I've never had to work with him, so I've never seen the dark side that a lot of people have. This casting, I think, is why the movie does work as well as it does, is because He matches Tom Cruise in star power, but he looks like your archetypical leading man in a way that Tom Cruise just physically can't. So making him the real number one, who's always first in command, I think that helps Cruise's performance as a quote-unquote underdog. And I do think Val Kilmer's done some great work. He's really good, great in Real Genius, which came out right before this.
Great in Real Genius?
I like Real Genius. Now,
Adam calling The Doors a brilliant film? Where the hell are you guys coming from here? All right, go ahead.
I love, he played Elvis in True Romance, so he worked with Tony Scott later.
There it is, yep.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is fucking great, but we're going to talk about him as Batman down the line.
Oh, yeah.
So that's coming up. We've already talked about him in Heat, which I think he's really good in.
Oh, he's great at that.
I just, you know, it's, I'm glad he's seemingly on the mend from his health issues, and I'm excited to see how they utilize him in the sequel and to what extent, because as of today I have read nothing on the second one, so I'm going in completely speaking of Batman puns, I'm going in cold.
Yeah, same here. Like, I had no idea he was even in it. That's how much I don't know. The only thing I know is somebody else that we're going to talk about here in a bit isn't in it. So we get a scene where we're hearing about Sliders Long and Distinguished Johnson. Iceman saying how good a man Kruger is. Here we go. Goddamn gay overtones. But this is all until Maverick serenades the blonde in the bar with "You've Lost That Loving Feeling," who just turns out to be Charlie, his new instructor.
Can I say, right, before we get into it, yeah, I watched this as a kid, probably starting at, I don't know, 9, 10 years old all the way up. And for a good, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years, I thought Goose, You Could Get Laid in a Place Like This was a joke, being that the fact that his name was Goose. Oh, the innocence of a child.
Oh, my God. Wow.
I swear to God.
That's awesome. Now, I'm sure I heard this around the house when I was a kid, but honestly, this was the movie to me that introduced me to You've Lost That Loving Feeling, and I actually used to own that 45, believe it or not. Now, let's talk about Kelly McGillis here. Now, I know she's not in the new one, and there's a whole hubbub over that, and we'll talk about that at the end of this podcast. But the way she got this role was Simpson and Bruckheimer saw her in Witness, and they loved her in it. And by the way, for those looking to expand their Harrison Ford filmography past Indy and Han, I highly recommend Witness. It's a fantastic film.
I recommend What Lies Beneath, yes.
All right, so I'll throw in my obligatory The Mosquito Coast recommendation.
Yeah, you always throw that in. I just edited a podcast with you where you once again talked about that. Anyway, her and Cruise, apparently they did not get along here at all. And in fact, I feel the film suffers with her in it, because one thing I noticed in the two viewings I did of this movie for this podcast is I would say she borders on toxic for me in this. Every time she's on screen, I don't like her line deliveries at all. And I'm not talking about looks here, people, so please don't send us any emails. I'm not talking looks. I'm talking straight acting ability. Maybe it's the fact that she did not like Tom Cruise on the set. Maybe it's the fact that they had to do so many goddamn boxes every time they had a scene together and she was sick of it, but I don't find any chemistry between them.
All right, well, if you recall, if you listened to us from the binge days when we did Mission Impossible, I made the comment that one of Tom Cruise's weaknesses as an actor is he's never had sexual chemistry with any of his leading ladies. Outside of a couple, mostly just Nicole Kidman, because they were actually dating at the time. And Nicole Kidman could have chemistry with, I don't know, the mop that I'm staring at right now. And I'm not just referring to Keith Urban's hair, but these scenes kill the movie. There's no spark between them. And I kind of wish they, I don't know, she's in a much more reputable position, but they're almost the same age, which I think somewhat hinders the movie. Maybe if she was not the head of security or whatever the heck she is, if she was like more middle management, I'd buy their relationship a little bit more. But the fact that she should clearly know better and still falls for this hotshot guy who, yeah, Tom Cruise is, I guess, objectively handsome. He got his fucking teeth fixed right before this movie, which was one of the best decisions he's ever made. As a, you know, as a bombshell leading lady, Kelly McGillis just doesn't cut it. And I think the only movies I've liked her in are, she was in The Accused. She was in that, and then she did, this is much, much later, she did a movie called Stakeland.
Oh, shit, that's right, she was in that. I forgot that she was in that.
Which is friggin' awesome.
It's a great film, yeah.
Never seen that, check it out, especially if you dig vampire movies.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
But I'm trying to think, like, around this time, who could have played this role and had better chemistry, but I'd have to seriously think about that. Because I don't think it's also in Tom Cruise's camp.
I like Kelly McGillis. I'm that one. I do think she's sultry and hot as hell in it. I like that it was because they met a civilian contractor that they based her character off of. So she's based actually on a real person who ended up being working in the government in the executive branch quite high up until recently. I think she does a really good job. This is where I'm going to, for the first time, say I don't think Cruise acts well in this movie when he's asked to do anything other than act like an action star. I think anytime he's asked to emote romantically or sad or anything else, I think he shows that he's not up to the challenge. And yeah, that maybe they didn't get along. Maybe Tom Cruise doesn't get along with anything that has a vagina, and that's why he doesn't have sexual chemistry. But
careful, we'll get sued. We're a brand new site, Adam. Don't get us sued, please.
Damn thetans, get out of here. So I'm not putting it on McGillis's back. I just don't think it's the back that Tom Cruise wants to jump on. And I think she's better in these kind of romantic scenes than he is. But I think she's playing it as an executive who's just kind of dicking around.
Maverick follows her to the bathroom, to which she still turns down his advances. And the next scene, we find out that she's Maverick's instructor. Yeah, they added this scene in the bathroom and her kind of hanging out with that older guy in the bar, because the executives were like, and this was just a quote I read from an executive, it's not from me. They were like, yeah, she looks like his mom. We need to make it seem like they're closer in age. And that's why they added this scene, which, you know, 80s, they didn't give a shit.
Well, it's because if an actress isn't 10 years younger than the actor she's romantically paired up with, it's not Hollywood's fucking image of how it, you know, life is.
Fair enough.
That's a shame. The guy she's actually in the booth with is one of the pilots from this. He's one of the technical help that they got. He's a Top Gun pilot.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Almost all the romantic scenes, as I was reading and looking at background, they added later. The something later when they, you know, in the elevator scene and stuff like that, they were like, oh, we need to get more of them together. Yeah, might not have been the way to go.
So he and Goose, they say that they have seen a MIG maneuver where he says that he was also inverted, to which Kilmer improvises a bullshit cough. That was all improvised, by the way, which is why you get the genuine reactions that you get.
Still do that move today.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, after all this, she just responds with, so you're the one. Oh, boy. Man.
You're the one who made the Kessel Run in less than 12 hours.
You're the one that's going to make a sequel out of this movie. Yeah,
nice. Now, for their first training mission, they're taking on Michael Ironside's Jester, with Cheap Trick's Mighty Wings playing in the background. You know, I don't think we can praise the aerial filming of this enough. Whatever you have to say about the movie and the contents of whatever, the love story and whatnot, it's devoid of CGI, and these flying scenes are just so badass. Like, I love watching these scenes.
Yeah, in addition to the cinematography, like, it's edited wonderfully. You know, later on, it's not so frenetic that you can't follow. It's not irritating. It's back and forth, and the way that that it's edited and across the axis of film, if you know how stuff is shot. It's crazy they did such a great job doing this, and that it's pleasing to follow.
Yeah, absolutely. So they catch up to Jester as Goose is egging Maverick on, and they walk on to him as Maverick does a flyby against orders, as some schlub spills his coffee. Now, is this supposed to make us like Maverick?
Of course.
Okay.
He's going up against the man. You know, that's the boss.
Okay.
He's fighting authority.
Okay, fighting authority. Gotcha. And this locker room scene is famous not for not only its extremely gay overtones, but because of the exchange between Maverick and Iceman, where they both agree that he's dangerous. Like, you saw this in the trailer. Any scene that you see isolated from this movie, you'll pretty much see this scene in it. Now, do you guys feel like Maverick's dangerous? We're going to have a lot of references to his father. And again, Star Wars, right? Like, we're talking about his father so much here. I'm feeling like we're in New Hope land, and we're hearing about Luke's father. Does this make him dangerous? I'm not getting that he is, except for maybe the inverted move. That's about it.
I think the movie misconstrues the difference between dangerous and reckless. And I think there's a difference. I think the movie presents him more as reckless and rebellious than actually truly dangerous. Because the big thing that happens in this movie, he's actually not really at fault for. It's just he puts himself in that headspace where he feels responsible. So maybe if what happens in the, like, an hour plus into the movie, it was his decision, as indirectly, that led to what happens, I would be willing to go with his more dangerous side. It's like those Steven Seagal movies from after Under Siege, where it's like, oh, we got to send in our best guy. So it's Steven Seagal, like 60 years old and nearsighted as shit. It's just a movie telling you that, so you have to believe it's true.
Yeah, it's. I think you nailed it. You know, reckless, aggressive, dangerous is not the word that comes to mind. I don't know. Maybe they thought that they were writing this script to try to convince him to do Green Lantern back then, and they confused Hal Jordan with Pete Mitchell here. Because, you know, same story, dead father, fighter pilot. The only thing he's missing is an alien in a ring. Because we never see dangerous. He doesn't put somebody else in danger. Even the situation that we get later on, it's never thinking that he's done something wrong.
No, and to be fair, that situation that we get later on was a rewrite. That was the one scene that the Navy changed. Because it was Cruz's fault that Goose died. But they changed it so that it would look like that the Navy was at fault. But we'll get to that scene when we get to it. Goose and Maverick, they get chewed out by Tom Skerritt for the flyby right before Skerritt admits that, again, he flew with his father. So we're getting the aura of his dad right up in the air here.
We're also getting Tom Skerritt showing up with both Scott brothers.
That's true. Good point. Very good point. And you know those guys talked, too. You know, like one day, Tony and him were smoking cigars one day, and it's like, yeah, you should get that guy. He was good in my movie. And I like Tom Skerritt in everything I see him in. Like, I think he's phenomenal. Even in, maybe we'll cover it one day, but the stupid Poltergeist 3, I think he's great in that. Like, he's just a very likable guy.
Definitely got a calming presence about him.
Absolutely. So Goose warns Maverick to stop his ways as his career's on the line, too. We get to Maverick and Charlie having another flirty exchange, just as she says that she doesn't date students. And it takes a lot more than fancy flying to get into bed with her.
No, it doesn't.
If that was true, he was cleared for takeoff from the opening scene.
There you go. Maverick comes over and tells Slider that he stinks, which was okay. And we get another famous scene in this movie, the infamous volleyball scene. Now, a little story about this scene. I have a sister who is 7 years younger than me. And after she was born, my parents would leave for dinner or something and leave me with this babysitter who would mostly just be watching my infant sister, not necessarily me. And I would coax her into playing Monopoly or something, like something to keep me entertained too, right? But every time we would, like, she would either put on, like, either Janet Jackson records or she would find something to put on. And, of course, you know, being a teenage girl, she would put Top Gun on. And one time this babysitter put this movie on and she would have to pause certain sections of the scene and just admire it for, like, a set of minutes. Which just blew my mind as a kid. I'm like, oh, my God, what are you doing? She's like, oh, no, he's flexing here. Watch, watch. And she just pauses it. I'm like, oh, my God. Does this scene have any place in this movie, honestly, when you look at it contextually?
You know what? I don't have a problem with this just because in downtime, stuff like that, and depending on where you are, but it's a fun little couple moments. It really doesn't make sense that Pete Mitchell, one, I can't hear Pete Mitchell without thinking a hair care product, even though I know it's Paul Mitchell.
Yes.
All I think is Pete Mitchell.
Yes, yes.
To be playing this up until you're freaking dripping sweat before you're about to go have a date. But I don't know. There's something about it being a fun break in a scene for 5 minutes that maybe I didn't understand as a kid. Maybe I'm questioning now. But yeah, I don't know. I've always liked the volleyball scene.
You know, I watched this scene and knowing behind the scenes as I do now, I'm just like, God, how did they make Tom Cruise look tall in this scene? You know, like, what were the tricks they had to use?
No shit.
I mean, that is some goddamn camera trickery going on right there. All right, let's ask the gay man on this podcast. Matt, did you think this scene had any place in this movie?
Hang on, I got to take the drool out of my mouth for 2 seconds. Does it fit in this movie? I'm going to say yes, because this movie is so soaked in a lot of things, especially in my household, but the... I'm gonna wait for him to calm down.
Sorry, this spit take I wasn't ready for.
This feels like a L.A. summer movie. Like, you're hot watching this.
Yeah.
So, of course, they'd be playing volleyball on their time off. I don't know why it's shot like a Calvin Klein commercial, but outside of that, it's... Obviously, it works for me on multiple signs. But, yeah, the Tom Cruise height thing is hilarious. Anthony Edwards is almost like a foot taller than him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You'd think they would, you know, why don't you get Maverick a stepladder or some platform sandals, you know, have him go on a sand mountain, be like a stationary server, just because it seems a little unfair in my humble estimation.
I tell you, Matt, if you like this, I recommend a little movie from the 80s called Side Out. I think you might get a kick out of that one, too.
That's a killer movie.
Well, this movie was made for the people who thought cruising wasn't gay enough.
Yeah. Nice. Maverick ditches Goose despite his pleas for one more game and somehow gets to head to Charlie's house for dinner. Very nice house, by the way. More talk about music here. Let's talk about this song. Now, Berlin will always be associated with this song. It's obviously their biggest hit. I can't remember too many more off the top of my head. I know my mom used to play their greatest hits, always to Take My Breath Away. But this song was already written by a famous 80s songwriter by the name of Giorgio Moroder, and lyrics by the guy who fixed his Ferrari that day. Yes, that is a true story. And much like this movie, Take My Breath Away was huge. Won the Academy Award for Best Song, believe it or not, and also the Golden Globe. They were going to offer it to the little New Age band called The Motels, who turned it down, but eventually they released their demo version of it because, of course, you're going to ride this wave. And then Marauder offered it to Berlin, and years later, they blame it for the demise of their career. I don't know. I think it's, yeah. In the four casinos I've worked at in the last 7-8 years, I have heard this song more times than I can count. They always have it on the 80s station, so you're hearing it over and over. I think it's a fine 80s song, and it definitely, sets the mood here. And it definitely makes up for any lack of chemistry we're having between these two. How do you guys feel about the Berlin song in this?
Well, it's saved by that, and Tony Scott is one of the masters of blue lighting in his
sections. Oh, my God, yeah. I haven't seen this much blue lighting since we watched Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5.
Yeah, at least this didn't look like it had Vaseline smeared all over the lanterns. Tom Cruise calls it hair gel.
I dig it. It's a good song. It does its job. It's tough because it is 30 years later. It's an elevator song. Everybody knows it. But in context, I can't imagine the type of hit that this would have been back then. It's massive. It's a good song. It does its job. One of the only female songs in this thing. And yeah, I like it. I don't love it, but can't tell you how many mixtapes I probably put it on.
No shit. My mom too.
It does well.
Question, what's a mixtape?
He's fucking fired.
God damn it.
Maverick just makes himself at home in her place, though she won't let him take a shower. And we get some getting to know you action here. And as a kid, I found these scenes just laborious. Exactly how I feel as an adult. Like, these scenes are really tough to watch.
Speaking of, she has the emotional range of Phoebe Cates in those Gremlins movies.
And she would prove herself to be a good actress in Witness and in The Accused, but you're absolutely right. She is awful here.
Yeah, she's there to put an exposition T-ball up on the tee for Tom Cruise, and he's doing smell the fart acting where he gets a weird look on his face just trying to remember details about his dad. And,
yes.
Oof.
Let's talk about Tom Cruise, actually, because we haven't really talked much about his performance.
Go.
Mm-hmm.
This is entirely a star vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
He had really only done The Outsiders, and he's a supporting character in that.
And Taps, yeah.
Don't forget Risky Business. He was on the
Jasper for that one.
Oh, yeah.
All the Right Moves.
Legend.
Yeah.
Okay, so he did more than I thought, but he's charismatic, or charismaverick. I don't know how.
Oh, my God. Bravo. Jesus Christ.
Charismatic.
I don't come out of this movie saying, wow, I can't wait to see the next movie this guy's in. There's a part of me that wants to see this movie with him and Val Kilmer switching roles.
Yeah, I agree. I thought of that while watching it this time, yeah.
I don't know, man. Back in those 80s, he flashes that smile, and he had chicks everywhere. Like, this dude was on all the People magazine top, sexiest people. I think he was married to Mimi Rogers around this time, and so he was a married guy. But it was Tom Cruise mania. You're right. This is a star vehicle. And you know what? And I never thought about it in that context, Matt, but you're right. That would have made for probably a more interesting movie if they would have switched roles. They both can pull off cocky, but I don't know. It's weird because can Tom Cruise really be an imposing antagonist as small as he is?
Did it in Collateral.
Collateral.
Well, yeah, later on in his career, that was 19 years later. He can do it, but I don't know if he could do it back in the 80s.
You could have made him, if he played Iceman, he would have been more like Johnny Lawrence in The Karate Kid.
Yeah, yeah.
Just like that guy you want to punch in the face, but because Iceman is so good at what he does, I think Tom Cruise could play that kind of arrogance.
Yeah.
Because he's got it pretty well. You know, I think it's weird how I think he's better in Days of Thunder, but I don't like the movie as much.
Yeah, I don't like that movie.
Completely agree with
you. And I think that was the movie where he actually married Nicole Kidman.
Mm-hmm. That was the one they met on. I'm with you guys. I hate hearing Cruise talk about how his mom would listen to sexy music, and we hear that, unsurprisingly, Maverick has little idea of what happened to his father. I mean, the scene sucks.
I don't think he feels mature enough to pull off that kind of role, like in the way that he's depicted in the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was only a year before this Legend came out.
Yeah, I forgot about that one, too.
Which, directed by Ridley, Sir Ridley.
Uh-huh. That's right.
And he in that movie, he feels like he's 16, 17 years old. You know, he feels so much younger. So for this to only be a year later, I don't know. Sometimes he feels like he's in his late 20s, as he should be, but he just doesn't – I don't know. There's no emotional heft that he's able to deliver yet at this point of his career.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's part of the lack of clarity about the characterizations in this movie. They don't say how old he is, how long he's been a pilot for. I think more context would have helped establish where he's at in his career. Because it almost plays like he's fresh out of the academy.
Mm-hmm.
He just lucked into going to Top Gun. But there's not – and you're right. Tom Cruise, for this time, all of his roles were as – you know, he went from Top Gun to the Young Gun.
Yeah.
There was Color of Money, where he plays Paul Newman's protege.
Mm-hmm.
You had Legend, where he looks like a 15-year-old boy or a girl, especially with that hair.
Mm-hmm.
And even, like, you watch the first Mission Impossible, he looks 15 with those glasses. It wasn't until I saw, ironically, stuff like, I don't know what the first movie was, like, probably Born on the 4th of July, where I'm like, oh, he can't actually play a deep character, which is why I reject people who say Tom Cruise can't act.
Yeah, I'm in that boat too.
Yep.
Say what you will about his personal life or whatever he does outside. I will say mostly everything he does on screen I like. Probably the only thing I don't think I've ever finished and I started of his was that stupid movie he did with Cameron Diaz, which is just god awful. Adam, shut up! You cannot like that movie. That's a horrible, horrible movie.
Dude, I don't like Vanilla. I love Vanilla.
No, not that one. No, I wasn't talking about that one.
You're talking about Night and Day.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck that.
Okay. No, maybe.
No, never mind. I have finished that.
Okay, all right. Oh, thank God.
I swear to God, that movie was made for the record. Like, James Mangold's like, yeah, that movie was a fucking nightmare to make.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, the reason why I like the Mission Impossible movie so much is that we don't delve that much into Ethan Hunt as a character. That's why I think they work as well as they do, on top of a million other things. Which, by the way, I really wish this year we were talking about Mission Impossible 7 because it was supposed to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
instead, I got suckered into doing this.
You don't seem to be having a bad time with it so far.
No. But there's other Tom Cruise movies, or Tony Scott movies for that matter, I'd rather be discussing.
He is, you know, give Cruise credit. He's going to anchor 3 summers in a row because he's going to do this and then Mission Impossible for the next 2 summers as well.
Yeah. I mean, the guy's still in the stratosphere. He won't fucking leave.
Oh, even the mummy couldn't kill
him. Yeah. And I thought for sure that would.
It tried.
Oh, man. I never saw that one, too. So Maverick then runs into Charlie in an elevator, which, as Adam alluded to earlier, this is a scene added months later because those pesky test audiences, they need more scenes of these two together. And they ship McGillis over from the movie that she was filming at the time to film this, which is why she's mysteriously wearing a hat in the scene. Her hair was a different color. It was much shorter. And like those strands coming out of her hat, those were like added. So, which I don't know if the scene added anything.
It, you know what? Clearly it shows that Tom Cruise doesn't know how to take a fucking shower. That's all that it added. And that whatever general that was or whatever enlisted that was that stepped in the elevator clearly knew they were fucking because he gave them a double take.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We then meet Goose's wife and child. I guess we'll get a real close look at Goose's son next week. But for now, we get to know his wife, played by a very young Meg Ryan here. She is a year or two away from stardom herself, and man, is she a bubbly bundle of energy, isn't she? She is just a fun, fun, fun character.
Adorable, and she steals the scene the second she walks
yeah.
in. I mean, if you didn't know she was going to be a star, I mean, she captures the screen as soon as she's on it.
Yeah, I don't know what cockpit she left her career in, though, because I have not seen her in
it's been
a very long time.
Yeah, it's been years. Yeah. She was really out there, too, like in the late 80s to the mid to late 90s. Like, she was out there, and you're right. I haven't heard from her since, God, probably 2003. I think she did a stupid boxing movie.
Against the Ropes.
Yeah, that was, like, literally the last time I think I saw her.
I think of, like, Kate and Leopold. That was, like, her last big. I love that movie. Shut your whore mouth.
Oh, man. God, what is up with you guys, man? You guys are just calling out some terrible movies today. Speaking of calling out, Charlie calls Maverick out in a class, and it pisses him off. He storms off in his bike, but is tracked down by her car, and she gives just this terrible speech about how she has fallen in love with him. And Matt, we get a type of love scene that, again, that we covered in Nightmare 5. Just completely basked in blue light here. Again, zero chemistry. I'm just not feeling these two.
Speaking of Top Gun 2, because I know she's in it, her line readings remind me of Jennifer Connelly in Labyrinth.
Oh, good call.
Yeah.
Where it's so stilted. I swear to God, there's points where I thought George Lucas was directing these love scenes. where it's just faster and more intense. Those are the only notes. And if you notice, a lot of Tony Scott's movies do not have a love interest component.
No.
He exists in a world of hyper-masculinity, but not in that sleazy, misanthropic way that Michael Bay would run with. He was very good at paternal movies. Like, one of the reasons why, not to go on a tangent, but I just love Man on Fire so much, that paternal relationship he has with, plays the girl in
Dakota
that movie.
Fanning.
What's her name? Dakota Fanning. The way that works is kind of, you do get a little bit of it here with the introducing Goose's family, which apparently they're going to run with in this new one. Mm-hmm. With the blank sheet of plywood known as Monica.
Charlie wakes up with a note folded like a plane right next to her bed, and we never actually know what this note says. We get the need for speed line, another famous line from this movie, as we cut to another training session, and they go after Viper. There's a cat and mouse game going on, and Maverick proves the adage that once you get laid, the fight is gone, and they end up getting locked on here. Maverick does the oddest shower pose I've ever seen as Iceman just lectures him. This was so weird, man. When he just has his leg up on the freaking bench, and he's just kind of leaned over. I'm like, what are you doing, dude? They're doing everything they can.
This would have actually been funny if Iceman was sitting down and his balls were like 6 feet.
It feels like he's airing up the nuts.
The towel's already open. It's like Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Oh, jeez. I guess they're trying to hide his height, right? Or lack thereof.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a way of doing that, but it was just an hot scene.
You know what's funny? Like, when I watch him and Val Kilmer together, and I say to myself, if Batman Forever was a full-on reboot, what if Tom Cruise played the Joker? I kind of would have liked to have seen that in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm. That would have been the time to do it.
Because Tom Cruise has still not done, of all the stuff he's done, he's never done a superhero movie.
No, he hasn't.
Or Harvey Dent.
Harvey Dent, he'd be great at.
Let him be Harvey, yeah.
So my hot take was Lex Luthor.
I don't think we could go with that.
He'd be arrogant enough. Let him be President Luthor.
Or Norman Osborn, I could have seen. I don't know if he would have done. I can't see him getting in the Green Goblin outfit, but he does all of his.
Well, we almost.
He does all of his own stunts.
We almost saw him as Green Lantern. They wanted him for that for years. We then get Goose's version of a serenade as Anthony Edwards pretends to play the piano and sings Great Balls of Fire. This was a scene added at the 18th moment, but it adds so much fun to this flick. We know what all this means, though, right, guys? It's about time to kill Goose.
Yep. Great Balls of Fire, I took that as a euphemism.
Yeah. I always love this scene, though. I've included it as my blooper stinger in between. I just find this so much fun.
That's a fun scene. They're all getting along. You know, one big family. What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah, and here's Charlie hanging out with them, which I thought was fun. We get another little scene of Charlie repeating the line Goose, his wife, says, and take me to bed or lose me forever.
I take the latter.
We're 2 weeks before graduation, boys, and we get another training scene as Goose and Maverick, they head up with the Iceman. Maverick and Goose, they go into a tailspin. They have to eject, but Goose ejects right into the roof of his plane before falling into the water, killing him. Now, as I mentioned earlier, this was changed by the Navy when they read the script. Originally, he died in a crash on an aircraft carrier because he was being too aggressive. But in order, again, to not look bad, they had the script changed. This scene killed me as a kid. I used to cry fucking crocodile tears when I watched this.
I like that this comes out of nowhere. The way it's handled is just so matter of fact. The roof comes off and his head smacks on a combination of that and the parachute. There's no slow motion. There's no overbearing sound effects. It's just played so matter of fact. And it makes you realize if Tony Scott directed this 20 years later, there would have been about 5 or 6 cuts and there would have been a loud thump when his head cracks open.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is just, I mean, they're going up to do the same thing. This is the 3rd or 4th montage we've seen of them going up, doing the school thing. No reason to think it's going to be any different. And for it to end this way, I know it's going to happen. Watching it, paying attention, taking notes this time, still freaking got me. I mean, it still does. You know, it's that error that wasn't anybody's fault. Just canopy didn't fly off the entire way, didn't clear. Man, it, yeah, I mean, it's... still hits. It's crazy. 36 years later that this scene still hits.
When I was a kid, I would always ask, what's all that green stuff in the water? Like, it blew my mind that they were in, like, green water, but it was explained to me later. I don't remember who exactly explained it to me. It might have been my dad, actually, who said, yeah, that's so that airplanes overhead can see them when they're trying to find them. I do like what this does to the Maverick character, though, and I'll tell you why. You know, in thinking about this character, Matt, you mentioned earlier that this movie has the depth of a puddle. When I was thinking about it, in context, what I came to the conclusion of, I think this comes down to the Maverick character having two people around him deal with death in different ways. Kruger faced it and ran, right? And Viper, Tom Skerritt, has seen death of a lot of people around him, including Maverick's father, by the way, and he still thrives. The question becomes, how is he going to face it? And we get a little bit of both from him. I thought this was a pretty cool bit of context the more I thought about it.
Yeah, it seems to be the first time maybe we've seen him lose. You know, The whole time we haven't had that before. And he didn't only lose something, he loses Goose. The one thing I can't stand is when he goes and he gets, you know, some of the memorabilia and he's in the room with Meg Ryan and he's trying to emote and she's tearing up. She's fantastic. She's bringing it all. And he's got the emotional talent of Goose's son in the next movie. But I don't know. I like what happens. I don't think Cruz is strong enough to properly capture the emotion that he should be coming out of it.
It seems, you
know, it's well written.
Yeah.
But he can't handle it.
It seems that he struggles to find himself be weak. You know, like he cannot be seen as weak on screen. And so I think if he thinks he's crying on screen, that means that he's weak. And I think as a character, as an actor, he refuses to do that.
Yeah, and I think it showed a lot around this time. Yeah, I mean, he would not do it. And there's still times, I mean, he's got so much talent. We see it later. At this point, he's incapable of bringing that out, you know. But even to act stoic or to be like, you know, that military person who doesn't cry, he doesn't have the gravitas to pull that off at this point in his career. He just doesn't.
All of the weight comes from Meg Ryan and Tony Scott's camera work, which I love that it's not a static shot. You follow him from behind as he walks into the room. You see it move around, pans to the wife. You can see the kid in the background. I think, again, this is why I think Scott is as great as he is he understands character, even when his actors aren't quite up to par just yet.
Maverick is getting lots of sympathy. Viper expresses it in a weird way, right after Maverick has showered and he's standing there in a towel, yet more of Cruz in a towel here. Maverick himself is found not guilty of any wrongdoing in Goose's death, but he quits anyway after his new co-pilot just isn't working for him despite being primed to fire. You know, they're up in the air, they have the shot dead on, but Cruz is just unwilling to do it, and this is the Kruger coming out of him. He's hesitating at this point. So Charlie can't talk him back in despite saying that she thought he was larger than life when she first met him, so I guess it's hopeless, right? But Maverick stops by to see Viper, who again reminds him that he flew with his dad, but Viper's pep talk is more successful than Charlie's, and he comes back to Top Gun. Again, interesting set of scenes, but Adam, you're absolutely right. The more he is asked to emote here, the more he's asked to talk to these characters, like the Meg Ryan character, like Charlie, like Tom Skerritt, they're the ones doing the heavy lifting, and he's not.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, that scene with Skerritt, I've always liked it, but Cruise is real. Like, he's bad in that scene, but Skerritt is pretty damn fantastic. Because he goes, he's comforting, and then, you know, when he's like, you think I should quit? I didn't say, you know, he can go angry. Like, he can switch on a dime. Cruise just can't bring the ratings for this. And maybe it's, no, I'm the hot shot pilot, I'm the hot shot. He's kind of got one speed. I think they say to the movie, Tom Cruise isn't acting unless he's going Mach 5 with his hair on fire. He's just, you know, he's got one way to go. And it is what it is. It's just, it's noticeable when everybody else is in these kind of scenes.
It's,
you know, when you're looking for that fun action, it's, man, there's no stopping it. When you're slowing it down, when you're trying to develop it a little bit, he just can't pull it out yet.
Yeah, and you know what? As bad as this is, it is miles above what we saw the year before in Legend. Because I remember, I haven't seen Legend in years. It's been at least 10 years since I watched it. But I remember him being really, really bad in that one. And the scene I'm really dreading in this new one is, and you know we're going to get it, like Miles Teller just confronting him about the death of his father. I'm like, oh God, that's going to be a horrible, just a horrible scene.
But we're also not very far from things like, you know, The Color of Money, which I know is a Paul Newman piece, but Cruise is
he's great
good
in that movie. And Rain Man, 2 years after and this, Rain is fantastic. Man, he would know, find
and
it.
He he deserved his Oscar for Born on the 4th of July.
He just didn't get it.
Yeah, it's just, you know what, really bad time to lose out to the actor that, you know, you were in with another movie. So he's getting there. It's just not here yet. But also, this isn't that kind of movie.
It isn't. And it goes back to what I was saying about Tony Scott earlier. I don't think he brings out good performances. You know, he gets good actors. You know, Denzel Washington's a fantastic actor, and he does good just because he's Denzel Washington. But it wasn't until he started working with Martin Scorsese and Barry Levinson that we started seeing that side of him come out and come out in a good way. Here, we're not seeing it in a good way, and these kinds of scenes kind of needed it. But you're right, Adam. This isn't that type of movie. But even in Star Wars, we get emotional scenes, and they work for me in a lot of those movies. Here, we're not seeing it.
I like sand.
We'll get there next year, boys. Hold it.
Yeah, I know. But the fucking... Who did he lose the Oscar to for Born on the 4th of July?
I believe he lost it to for Rain Man. Didn't he lose it to
No, he didn't, he lost to Daniel Day-Lewis.
That's what it was, yeah.
Boy.
Which everybody and their mother does.
Boy, yeah. That's real shameful. You lose the Oscar to Daniel Day-Lewis.
It was his first, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. He's been nominated a few times. I don't think he's ever going to win unless he pulled a Will Smith and said, make me a movie that will win me an Oscar.
I don't know, man. DiCaprio won it, and Will Smith won it. I see him winning one eventually. I see him getting Lifetime Award eventually.
He'll get Lifetime. He should have got supporting twice by now, but yeah.
Paul Newman got the Lifetime for Color of Money.
Won an Oscar.
Yeah, well, Paul Newman got the Lifetime for Color of Money. You know, that was a movie that he was not good in. I am not a fan of that movie at all. I think eventually Tom Cruise will get that same exact Oscar. He's going to get the best picture, or he'll get the best actor, but it'll be because of his body of work, not necessarily for the work he gets it for. Maverick graduates, yet we learn that there's a crisis. TIE fighters are on their way. James Toback is back, as we're on the Indian Ocean once again, and once again everyone is sweaty. But this so-called crisis is perfectly timed, isn't it? Like, right during graduation.
You don't get orders from graduate. Like, that's not how military orders were. You don't get them from shore to go. No, you get a carrier group that's already in the area. Oof. But it works. And how many of these people are freaking drunk?
Yeah, I know.
Graduation party.
I know. Here we go.
Yeah, you want these people to go fly planes now?
What are they, Delta pilots? Just kidding, Delta. Please don't sue, but you can sponsor us.
There you go. Hollywood. We learned that Hollywood has a hard-on. Interesting line of dialogue there.
Not the first or last in this
movie. So enemies must be close. And we see these enemies, these TIE fighters up close, and the battle begins. Maverick, late to the party, is sent up. We get some mid-air chases, near collisions, and Maverick disengages, pissing off both Iceman and James Toback. I love, love, love when we see Toback just go, God damn it, Maverick! Like, he does it a couple times in this. I fucking love it every time. That dude's just the best. But he comes back, and he takes out a TIE fighter. Iceman takes one out himself, and Maverick misses with a missile. But Iceman doesn't. So they have each other's backs here. How are you guys feeling about the fight going on up here? I think it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, for 2-on-5, 2-on-6, whatever it is, but it's a fun, engaging, not to be, you know, re-engaging. But yeah, I mean, for something that's got to be, I can't imagine trying to storyboard this.
Oh, my God, yeah.
You know, I don't know. There's planes. They're fighting up in the sky. But yeah, I mean, it's action-packed. It's fun. It's kinetic in just all ways. I don't think it's as good as the scenes that we got on Miramar when they were in school. Mm-hmm. You know, there was something about those that was just a motorcycle ripping down full speed. This, you're in a car, the top is on. It's fun, but it's just not quite the same level of intensity.
I'm sort of with Adam where I think this is not the standout sequence of the movie. So as a climax, it is slightly underwhelming, but there is the, I guess you'd call it the thematic through line of in the full circle aspect of him not leaving his wingman behind, which he got chastised for earlier on. So I guess it works, but again, the storytelling in this movie is not the reason why it works.
Yeah, good point.
And the fact that this was written by two people blows my mind.
Three, if you count Warren Skerrin. Warren Skerrin, who we'll be talking about when we do Batman, he was brought in for some reason to do some rewrites on the script.
And these two, so it's Jim Cash and Jack Epps Jr., who worked on, so they're working on this new one.
Everybody's working on the new one.
Yeah, well, they're credited for based on characters that playing this. But they did Turner and Hooch, Dick Tracy, Anaconda, and Flintstones and Viva Rock Vegas.
Fucking
that
God.
That is not a compelling pedigree. Like,
barf.
Man. I like Anaconda, but it's fucking garbage.
That's awful, dude. I don't even like that, ironically. So they have one missile left as they're getting shot at themselves. Maverick does a maneuver that has gotten him in trouble, the flyby, to mess up the other guy, and he takes him out, and his buddy flies away like Darth Vader. I'll get the Empire back together and come back. Maverick gets a standing ovation when he lands, and Iceman promptly tells him that he can be his wingman anytime. And Matt's like, yeah, me too.
Yeah, I could see Tom Cruise in the Robin suit.
Slid down more than one bat pole.
Yeah. Jesus Christ.
Allegedly.
Allegedly.
Thank you. Now I have a question, and it might be an obvious question, but it's a question I have nonetheless, and I've been asking it since I was a kid. Why does Maverick throw Goose's wings into the ocean?
He's letting them go. He's not going to hold on to the, you know, to that, and that's, Goose was in the Navy. That's where, you know, this isn't Air Force, it's Navy. Uh-huh. And that's where Goose would have wanted to go. I always wondered that too. I think it was my dad that explained it to me. It's just like, that's the type of thing you would do.
I'm going to laugh if in this new one, somehow his son has the dog tags.
Oh, my God. No.
Oh, God damn it,
Matt. If they'll forget about that level of continuity.
Oh, my God.
Oh.
So if that happens, please don't blame me.
Oh, my fucking God. Oh, and you know what? Vomiting in my mouth right
Miles
now.
Miles Teller was working on a submarine. They came across him, and he decided to become a pilot instead.
Just stop. 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 Maverick tells Toback that he is thinking of being an instructor. Hope we eventually get this straightened out, guys. speaking of getting straightened out, I guess we have to close out the love story here. Maverick puts you...
No, we don't.
Maverick puts you've lost that loving feeling on the jukebox, rehashes lines earlier in the movie that Charlie said right back to her, and we get some Predator-style credits before we cut to... I had completely forgotten that everybody had their moment to shine here as they get their few seconds before their names flashed. And we get what was at the time was my favorite song on the soundtrack as a kid, and that was Mighty Wings by Cheap Trick. I used to love this fucking song. Although, in looking at Cheap Trick's career, I don't think they knew whether they were hair metal or not. But this song was badass. I used to love this fucking song. And that does it for Top Gun, boys. Oh, boy. Scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Top Gun? I've known Adam longer, so I'll go with Matt. Matt, you go first, sir.
Boy. So, this movie is one of the textbook examples of style over substance. But in a way that is both a positive and a negative. If you're going into this for pure escapism, you're probably going to get a lot more out of this movie than if you're someone like me who's very into the, you know, the storytelling and the characterization, things like that, especially in a movie like this that is structured almost like an underdog sports movie, which were big in the 80s. You know, confidence is not Maverick's problem. If this guy was a quarterback, he'd be Jim McMahon. And there is Tony Scott is the real star of this movie as far as the dogfighting and the camera work and his lighting. I think he showed the world why he was going to be taking on Beverly Hills Cop 2 and become a very sought-after director for pretty much the rest of his career. Unfortunately, a lot of the anchors of this movie, like the love subplot, are shockingly dull because this is a male bonding movie in a best sense, and it's only here to prohibit the idea that this movie is a gay fantasy. Because this training corps, they're basically a fraternity of guys. It's the Omegas, if they were competent, from Animal House. There's all the research, it's there on screen, and you can see that it's made out of love. But for a Tom Cruise star vehicle, it's not all that great of a showcase for his talent. And I do think the pro-military aspect, especially at the time, looking at it now, doesn't sit well with me. And it's amazing we're getting a sequel almost 40 years later. So taking everything into consideration, weighing my personal enjoyment and my issues with it, I am going to give it a 7. I have fun with it. But this is not even in my top 5 Tony Scott films. And this is certainly not one of my favorite Tom Cruise vehicles. I think there's better stuff out there. It is what it is, and you have to accept it or you're going to be disappointed, because if you're looking for something really deep or transformative as a blockbuster, you're not going to find it here.
All right. After all that, 7 from Matt. I'm surprised at that score, actually. I thought it was going to be lower than that. Adam, gentleman I grew up with, what do you give Top Gun, sir?
Are you still straight?
Yeah, we're still straight.
You know, Matt brings up a really good point. You know, you kind of got to decide what you want when you're going to watch this movie. This movie had a lot of things going for it, but you know what other movie had a lot of things going for it and came out the same year? Iron Eagle. And this could have been that. You know, when you think about it, one, I don't hate Iron Eagle, but, you know, kind of different way to go. This is a Tom Cruise starring vehicle. This is what took his career and frickin' lit the fire, kicked the tires, and put it into overdrive. And the movies he did starting here and continuing on were just, I mean, it was nonstop. He was on cruise control, you know, so to speak. Does he act wonderful in this movie? No, absolutely not. But I can have a hamburger in a lot of different places. I can go into a Vic Stewart's high-end chop house and still get a hamburger. Doesn't mean I'm going to enjoy it more or less than getting a different type of hamburger if I want to go to a Wendy's. There's a lot of different ways to cook a hamburger. And there's a lot of different ways to do a movie. If I want a deep, introspective type of movie on life, death, afterlife, things like that, I'll watch, you know, Vanilla Sky. If I want a deep dive into Dark Side of Marriage and Secrets and things like that, I'll watch Eyes Wide Shut. If I want something on in the background with my, or not even in the background, just in front of me with my sound system on and TV blaring, I'm putting in Top Gun. When I used to be a home theater manager and there was a new type of system that came out, believe me, this is what did it. Okay, HD DVD, this movie is what we used to test and showcase every new system because it was absolutely that phenomenal. It was the jets taking off from the carrier, the opening scene. It's not a great movie, but it's a great watch, and that holds a hell of a lot of weight. Even now, in my 40s, I'm just as enamored and just have such a good time watching it as I did 20 and 30 years ago. And yeah, I mean, it's got a lot of great people in it, and I think that helps saves it. The supporting cast, I think, are more than up to the job of lifting up Tom Cruise so that he can look them in the eye. So for me, it's an 8. I still have a good time with it, and I take it on face value for what it is, and that's what I'm going to evaluate it on. So 8 for Top Gun.
Man, an 8 and a 7. Boy, I was not expecting those two high scores. I think it's fitting that the first time I watched this movie, I watched it immediately after one of the biggest wrestling events of all time. WrestleMania 3 is looked at as one of the biggest and best wrestling events ever. And this is looked at as one of the biggest movies of 1986. It's looked at as an exhilaration. It's looked at as not much more than, and I hate saying this, but it's true with this movie. Just turn off your brain and watch it. The problem with this podcast is I can't turn off my brain and watch these things because these questions that I didn't have as an 8-9-year-old are coming up now. And when I watch this as a 44-year-old, I'm like, there's nothing really deep here. There's a little bit of Maverick stuff in the middle or towards the end that I did like when Goose is killed that I mentioned earlier. But other than that, these scenes with Kelly McGillis are toxic to me. I could not believe in returning to this how bad those scenes are. How bad they are together. And again, maybe it's because they didn't like each other. We did hear a lot about this movie not being a very fun shoot. I can imagine with Tony Scott, with the way these aerial scenes are filmed, with how someone died on this movie. We didn't mention that, but one of the stunt flyers did die on this, and it is dedicated to him at the end of this movie. The credit's dedicated to him. I don't think it was a fun set to be on, and I think a little bit of that shows on screen. But still, these flying scenes, these scenes with Maverick and Iceman going at it, I have a pretty good time with it. It's just when you look at the depth of the Maverick character, I get nothing. For pure exhilaration, I will go ahead and give it a 6. I think it's definitely watchable, but it's not something that you can take away and say, you know what, that wasn't that good of a burger, to use Adam's metaphor earlier. So 6 out of 10 from me, but something tells me, given the people involved in the writing of this new one, we're not going to get that for this next movie. You know, when I heard this movie was coming out, I had to give the big sigh and say, yeah, right. In fact, I believe the three of us were kind of in a, we have a chat, we have an ongoing chat between the three of us. And I think we even had words to say that, like, oh my God, like how many times are we going to hear this and not have it come out? We'll talk about all the behind the scenes next time about, you know, what happened with this movie. But guys, what are you expecting next week with Top Gun Maverick?
I really wish Tony Scott was alive to have made this movie, but unfortunately, you know, we lost him about 10 years ago. But I heard that this was from the director of Tron Legacy and Oblivion. I said, fuck this, because I like either of those movies. Sorry, Adam, I know you like Oblivion.
He loves Tron Legacy too, by the way. Loves it.
When we do the Tron show, if the Jared Leto movie ever comes out, we'll talk about that. But my question was always, why now? You're talking almost 40 years later. That is a long time to do a legacy sequel. At least something like Halloween, they had made movies years and years and various entries afterwards. So I always wondered, what's the appeal beyond 80s nostalgia? And as of now, I still don't see one, despite the rave reviews. And we're talking like people saying this is just a great movie, like it's got depth, it's got resonance, all the stuff that the original does not possess, really. I'm concerned still, because I very much believe it when I'll see it, and I'm also 3 or 4 beers deep right now, so I will say Christopher McQuarrie being involved has me very excited, because I just love the Mission Impossible work he's done. I think he's a great writer. Him and Tom Cruise have a good rapport. And Miles Teller aside, I like this cast. Jennifer Connelly, John Hamm, Ed Harris. These are all very talented people that they're bringing in. So as long as they have a story to tell, I'm sure they'll justify it in some way. But I'm still not 100% sold.
Yeah, I'm there with Matt where when this was announced, I'm like, why? Like, for what reason? And I saw the first trailer and I went, oh, shit, okay, I guess I'm going to see Top Gun Maverick. When I saw, what did I see recently, Multiverse of Madness, they had like a 6-minute preview of this in it for the Dolby screen that I saw, and it looked impressive. Matt is excited for the writer, and I am as well, because I really like what McQuarrie has done and the changes that he brought to the Mission franchise, especially the last couple. I like Kaczynski as a director a bunch. It's amazing that this is only his 4th movie. He did Tron, he did Oblivion, which was based off a graphic novel he wrote himself. He did that firefighting movie where they dropped in for smoke jumpers, I can't remember the name of it, and this. So I'm surprised the guy hasn't done more films. I hope with this and Oblivion that he's not tying his hitch to Tom Cruise, but I'm excited, and I'm trying not to let the reviews sway me because I'm seeing them and I don't want to see them. I haven't read anything, but the news is leaking out about what people think and I don't want to believe it. Miles Teller is poisonous to me on screen though, and I'm not looking forward to it. Like I can't fucking stand watching him act. I can't stand him in films. It's for that reason I've never watched that drum movie, Whiplash. So
you gotta watch it because it's such a great movie.
I hear it's great. I hate Miles Teller.
It's fantastic.
But you'll love it because J.K. Simmons beats the shit out of him.
That's what I hear. Like J.K. Simmons at least beats the shit out of him. You'll like it.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see what they tell. I'm hoping it's a story worth telling. And yeah, the cast that they've assembled, the writer, the director, I mean, everything is there, and I hope it delivers, because why would you do this? Yeah, we'll find out soon.
You know, I'm kind of in between you two. I'm a little bit skeptical and a little bit optimistic. You mentioned, Adam, that Krasinski, you hope he hasn't tied his hitch to Tom Cruise. It seems like that's exactly what McQuarrie has done, because this is, what, the third or fourth time they've worked together. And hey, you know what? Cruise has done it in the past. He did it with Cameron Crowe back in the 90s. Like, once you like working with somebody, you keep working with that person. If you're willing to tolerate Tom Cruise, mm-hmm. which for all stories, I mean, we don't know anything for sure, but there are some things coming out about him on sets that he doesn't seem like a fun person to work with on these movies. And so if you can find somebody who can tolerate you, you keep him around. And apparently he has. I cannot say I am too optimistic, but for some reason I am looking forward to it, which is a really weird place to be in, because yeah, the reviews have been phenomenal. I will not know until I step into that IMAX theater and I sit down and watch this thing exactly how I'm going to feel. But in the lead up to this, I'm kind of excited, although, you know, again, 40 years later is a long time. And as you said, Matt, we're not talking legacy here. Like, we're talking a continuation of the Maverick character. Oh, it kind of scares me, but we'll see. Krasinski is not really good with character development. However, Christopher McQuarrie is. So we'll see how that balances out. But it's something that I am extremely curious about. And yeah, Matt, I'm with you. I do kind of wish that Tony Scott was able to make this. In fact, I think the fact that he died was probably the only reason why they finally got this thing springboarded, at least initially. And then it went through a few more hands right before we're getting this release. But yeah, it's coming out at the right time. You know, it's starting to get hot. I'm ready for it. So one thing I did want to mention too, boys, is this is the first time we've actually recorded since we've officially launched. We've recorded quite a few podcasts since, and the majority of those haven't been released yet, but this is the first actual podcast we've done since we've launched the actual site, and I just wanted to say thank you to everybody who's supported us in this venture. It's been extremely fun to get back into the podcast realm. I know Matt has stuff he has planned, Adam has stuff planned, but this whole thing of having our own site, it's a hell of a lot of work, but it's stuff that I really enjoy, and we have somebody working behind the scenes to help us who has been nothing but fucking great at everything we've asked him to do. It's been really fun to podcast again, and I can't thank you two enough, and everybody else out there listening. It's because of all you guys that we're still doing this, and we're having a fun time doing it.
I hate to correct you. This is actually the second we have done, because Fantastic Beasts was a new movie.
Did we launch by that time? I don't know if we had officially launched by that time. Maybe we had. I don't remember mentioning it at the end of that podcast. Maybe that's why I thought of it that way.
I don't know, but you're right that this will be like the first new movie that we've done since we've launched, if that makes any sense, because we did choose to launch the site by closing the book on certain franchises with Texas Chainsaw and Dr. Sleep. Fantastic Beasts was the logical choice to kickstart, so looking at Top Gun, it made sense to do this as a double feature, because it closes out a few weeks of scheduling. And then from there, we're really off on our own thing. Have we decided what's going to be after Top Gun 2?
It's going to be Batman.
Okay.
We're going to start the Batman franchise going. And then, you know, some hiccups along the way. And eventually we'll get the Scorsese, DiCaprio stuff out, which have been really fun recordings as well. But yeah, we're going to have Batman come out in between the Schumacher stuff and Snyderverse, I guess you can say. We'll have some stuff along the way, maybe stuff sprinkled in. But yeah, it's going to be Batman for the majority of it. And who knows what we'll decide to do in the midst of it. But that's what we have looking at so far. Adam, how about you, sir? How are you feeling about this new venture?
This has been great. I want to thank everybody who's liked, who's shared, who's downloaded and listened to us. For everybody that sent comments, they're greatly appreciated. And believe me, we read them, we love them, we share them to each other, and it gives us some great feels. So for anybody that even takes the time to listen to us, we want to say thank you. Please keep doing it. Please share. It's just us just hanging out, talking movies, because we were going to do it anyway. So might as well put a mic on and let you listen along to our discussion. Let us know what you want. Let us know what you want to hear. Let us know what you like and dislike. And please keep listening, because we're going to keep talking.
And there's already a story associated with the viewing of Top Gun, and it hasn't even happened yet. But I'll save that for the next podcast, because it needs to be safe for that time. But boys, I can't be happier to join you guys with this. We'll see what being back in the air with Tom Cruise is like next week. But until then, sorry, Goose, but it's time to podcast the tower. Thanks, guys.
I see that you're hurting. Why'd you take so long to tell me you need me? I see that.
In case some of you wonder who the best is, they're up here on this plaque on the wall. The best driver in Israel from each class has his name on it. And they have the option to come back here to be Top Gun instructors. You think your name's gonna be on that plaque?
So cry tonight, but don't you let go of my hand. You can cry.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively on Percolated Media.
I don't like you because you're dangerous.
That's right. I am dangerous.
Join us next week for an entirely new review.
Clock is ticking, and as of now, we are keeping score.
It's just a ball of dust underneath my feet. The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan. Voiceover by Adam.
There are no points for second place.
Edited by Garrett. The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is for review and discussion, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Okay, believe it or not, I have a shit ton of notes on this fucking movie. And no, they're not all gay overtones.
What gay overtones?
Yeah.
Goodness gracious, red balls of fire!
And the one and only, probably a guy I watched this with a couple times back in the day, Mr. Adam Bunge. What's up, Adam? Adam, are you there?
Oh, his internet connection's in the danger zone.
Oh, fuck.
Test, got it. Nope.
There you are. Okay, you're good.
Shoot, sorry, you're gonna do it again.
Yeah, go ahead. It's okay. I just threw it to you. I just said, "How you doing, Adam?"
Oh, good.
Goodness gracious, red balls of fire!
That was my first time experiencing this movie, and I loved it at that time. Adam, I'm sure I watched this with you a number of times. What was your first experience watching this? Did he disappear again?
I don't know, did he?
I don't know. He's on mute. Adam, are you there? Hello? There you are. Are you lagging or what's going on over there?
You know what? I don't know. My interface just completely got wonky for Skype.
Okay. All right.
I don't know what. You know what? I can at least mute and unmute myself, so.
Well, that's good.
Oh, there it is. It's back. Shit. Sorry. All right. It'll be fine from now on.
Okay. I hope so. what was your first experience? What was your first experience watching this, sir?
Goodness gracious, red balls of fire!
By the way, crew saying, talk to me, Goose, I say that all the time in my life. Mostly on the radios at my work. Like, we keep in contact with our crew through radios, and so, you know, if... Huh?
What you call your penis is something I don't need to hear about.
Goodness gracious, red balls of fire!
He was taking any piece of work because he was still up and coming at the time.
He was, yeah.
He had only done, like, I don't know, Fraternity Vacation with frickin' Cameron Dye and Stephen Jeffries.
He was in what, Tapeheads was another one that he was in?
Like, yeah, that was after this.
Oh, that was after this? Okay.
Goodness gracious, red balls of fire!
That's how much I don't know. The only thing I know is somebody else that we're going to talk about here in a bit isn't in it. So we get a scene where Babe, can you be a little quiet? It's all right.
Thanks, babe.
Thank you. And love you.
Speaking of Rossovich, he was actually in The Terminator. He's in it for a little bit.
Yeah, for an instant, yeah.
Yeah, it's blinking, you miss it, but that I think that was just trying to help out his buddy.
To help out his buddy, exactly.
Goodness gracious, red balls of fire!
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that elevator scene. And I think that was added because of test scientists. Test scientists really, and this was back when test scientists meant something. You know, they wanted more romance between the two.
Well, they could keep looking because they don't find it in this movie.
Hold on a second, guys. No, what you got going on in there? Because I can hear it through the microphone.
I'm cooking.
Oh, okay.
Am I making too much noise?
Yeah, it's a lot of noise.
I'm so...
sabotaging this review on purpose because it's Tom Cruise.
The Church of Scientology calls.
Goodness gracious, red balls of fire!
We get to Maverick and Charlie having another flirty exchange, just as she says that she doesn't date students. And it takes a lot more than fancy flying to get into bed with her.
No, it doesn't.
We'll get there.
Apparently, if that was true, he was cleared for takeoff.
Say that again because you cut out. Say it again.
If that was true, he was cleared for takeoff from the opening scene.
There you go.
Goodness gracious, red balls of fire!
Does this scene have any place in this movie, honestly, when you look at it contextually?
Well, the amazing thing is, I mean, it wasn't even supposed to be this song for it. Originally, Elton John was hired to perform a piece, but he said, holy shit, this scene is too gay for me.
Oh my god. So let's call Kenny Loggins.
Sorry. I found that funny.
Wow, that is funny. I didn't even know that.
No, I'm fucking around.
Oh.
It's not true.
You had me going, goddammit.
Goodness gracious, red balls of fire!
So Maverick ditches... God damn it.
Goodness gracious, red balls of fire!
We almost saw him as Green Lantern. They wanted him for that for years.
Well, for the record, Green Lantern is very much Top Gun. They're very similar. If they do this Green Lantern core show, you could cast him as one of the Green Lanterns, because it's not just one. Because Adam and I could talk about this for 30 minutes, if there's not just one Green Lantern. Eric Pryor's like, oh my god, will you both shut up?
It'd be amazing if they
draw you a flowchart and put it on the website.
Imagine if they kill off Hal Jordan in the pilot, and he is Hal Jordan. Great.
Yeah, you guys are speaking Chinese at this point. We then get...
I don't know, could you play Wolverine just to hear the internet?
He's short enough.
Hey, everyone, be careful what you wish for. You wanted a short Wolverine. Here you go.
Oh, man, could you imagine the outcry? Ugh.
Goodness gracious, red balls of fire!
But even in Star Wars, we get emotional scenes. And they work, for me, in a lot of those movies. Here, we're not seeing it.
I like sand.
We'll get there next year, boys. Hold it.
Yeah, I know. But the fucking... Who did he lose the Oscar to for Born on the 4th of July?
I believe he lost it to, for Rain Man. Didn't he lose it to,
Oh, he didn't, he lost to Daniel Day-Lewis.
That's what it was, yeah.
Boy.
Which everybody and their mother does.
Boy, yeah. That's real shameful. You lose the Oscar to Daniel Day-Lewis.
That was his first, I think, wasn't
it? Yeah. It was.
Yeah. Yeah, he's been nominated a few times. I don't think he's ever going to win unless he pulled a Will Smith and said, make me a movie that will win me an Oscar.
I don't know, man. DiCaprio won it and Will Smith won it. I see him winning one eventually. I see him getting Lifetime Award eventually.
He'll get Lifetime. He should have got supporting twice by now, but yeah.
Well, Paul Newman got the Lifetime for Color or Money.
Trump won an Oscar.
Yeah, well, Paul Newman got the Lifetime for Color or Money. You know, that was a movie that he was not good in. I am not a fan of that movie at all. I think eventually Tom Cruise will get that same exact Oscar. He's going to get the best picture, or he'll get the best actor, but it'll be because of his body of work, not necessarily for the work he gets it for.
I don't see it happening, because he'll have to get out of blockbuster land.
Well, yeah, and he does that every once in a while. We said that during Mission Impossible. During Mission Impossible, he would do one, and then he would do like a couple other films to kind of establish his acting cred. But when those flopped, he would go right back to the Mission Impossible barrel. You know,
like nowadays, all of his last decade: Jack Reacher, Oblivion, Edge of Tomorrow, Mission Impossible 5, Jack Reacher 2, The Mummy, Mission Impossible 6, Top Gun 2.
Yeah.
So, it really. I guess the last prestige movie he did was frickin', was that one with Robert Redford and Meryl Streep? It was like Lions for Sheep,
oh my
or whatever
God,
the hell.
I forgot that he was in this.
That piece of
yeah,
crap.
I forgot he was in that stupid movie.
See, and I thought he'd at least, I thought Magnolia was going to be his supporting actor.
Oh, I hate that movie with a passion. Ooh.
I know, yeah, but he deserves it.
Ooh, I fucking hate that movie.
So for the record, he lost to Michael Caine that year.
Ah.
Well, for the record, that was the year Haley Joel Osment should have won for The Sixth Sense, and he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was also for the record, because this movie doesn't have a lot of depth, so there's not much we can talk about.
Yeah.
Michael Caine, Tom Cruise, Michael Clark Duncan, Jude Law, Haley Joel Osment.
No, should have been MCD.
Longest blooper ever.
The blooper was the size of a tangerine.
So.
Ow! You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain!